My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am sitting here with William Sargent. This is the first time we've talked, but I am very excited for tonight's episode because we're going to talk about a place that's very exotic to me. I've never actually been on the ground there, only through the airport, and that is Hong Kong. And in addition to that, we're going to talk about some really interesting topics, including these snake safaris that you can take with William. So, William, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So I always like to start off these conversations by just kind of learning more about how you ended up getting into snakes. A lot of people think people like us are a little bit strange. To us, it's perfectly normal, but to others, to a lot of people, it's pretty eccentric. So is this something that kind of hits you when you're a young child? Is it something that hits you later in life?
Yeah, it's quite a common question, isn't it, for all of us, actually. I would say that my interest came from my brother. He was interested, his older brother, so first. And him and his friend used to go out in Hong Kong as kids looking for snakes, and they'd bring them home, show me snakes. Some of them would be potentially dangerous, others would not. And, as a young boy, the idea of a potentially dangerous animal is quite exciting. And then as I learned more about it, you realize actually they don't necessarily have to be dangerous, and how you approach it and just became more and more fascinated by it. So one of the things is as a kid, you're interested in all these various things like swimming or taekwondo or football. And as you get older, you drop these. But the snake thing hung around and stayed to my adult life. And so, yeah, that's how I'm here today.
Yeah. And so how old were you when your brother was taking you out on these adventures and introducing you to snakes?
I think I was probably about 9 or 10 years old. I remember coming home. I must have been 10 or 11 with the first snake I ever caught, which was, at the time, I didn't even know what it was, to be honest with you. I brought it home in a little box, and to my mom's horror, I said, look what I found outside. I think it was a half-dead snake. Something had happened to it. But that was my first snake-catching experience. And I took this thing home, and I had it in my head that snakes have to be in warm places. So we've got these little shoe heaters in the cupboards, and I put it on top of one of those. And sure enough, the next day, my whole room stank, and I'd killed the snake, and it had gone off, and the whole room stank. And that was literally my first husbandry experience into keeping snakes as a 10 or 11-year-old.
That's great. So as you grew up, so you grew up in Hong Kong, first of all, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right. My dad moved here in 78. I was 2 years old. He's an engineer, and there were a lot of engineering projects in Hong Kong. They built the underground, the MTR, which is the subway in the US. And yeah, we stayed ever since. And people will be surprised to learn, actually, Hong Kong has got a lot of wildlife, flora and fauna. 40% of Hong Kong is actually protected country parks, which people don't realize. And we have a huge diversity of snakes and other wildlife here.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I want to get to that because I was telling you before we started recording here, like I always pictured Hong Kong as just, essentially concrete and steel. So I'm excited to get to that. But I do want to continue hearing more about how you ended up getting to where you are today. So you've grown up in Hong Kong. You're interested in these animals. You're seeing these animals in the wild. You've been introduced by by your brother. And so you're going through high school. Was there a point where you realized that this is something that you could possibly have a career in, something that you could continue, you know, working in the snake world as you became an adult? Or when did that light switch kind of turn for you?
Well, it's a really, really interesting question. And I'm sure a lot of people have gone through the same thing. But when I was growing up and had this interest and passion in snakes, you know, I had all these different snakes in my room and I was breeding mice to feed them. And it was really, took a lot of time. But I didn't really tell anyone, because in those days it was considered very odd and unusual, you know, to why on earth would you be keeping snakes? And I sort of did it, not so much hidden, but I was just very quiet about it. It was just this little hobby of mine on the side. And I think one of the biggest changes, I guess, was the advent of the internet. And that was connecting people with community. And that made a massive difference. Suddenly, you were with like-minded people. And you could build this community. It was a really kind of eye-opening thing. You think, oh, I'm a bit odd for liking a snake. Actually, there's other people, and these are normal people. And then from there, really, really, it grew. And I mean, in Hong Kong, we have a massive community now, herpetologists who are interested in this kind of thing. And I think it wasn't a one thing, but I'd say the internet was definitely one of the biggest catalysts for moving it from a kind of very casual hobby to something a little bit more formal.
Yeah, that's great. And so today, so you run a company that does events, is that right?
Exactly. So, I mean, one thing to clarify, the snakes thing is not a career per se. It's a little side gig, if you will, and a passion. And I do these safaris, which, they're commercially charged and things like that, but it's still not my number one business. I do have my own events business, which is organizing outdoor corporate events.
Yeah, excellent. But you still have found the way to, based on everything you're doing, to be involved in snakes in the area you work and kind of develop this, what to me is kind of a really interesting niche. And I want to get to some of that niche and how you get there. But first, let's go back to Hong Kong. So you mentioned that people would be surprised, and I was definitely surprised to hear that I think it's at 40% of Hong Kong is actually protected or preserve area. Is that the number I heard?
Yeah, it's actually it's one of the highest in the world for the percentage of landmass protected for country park. Hong Kong is in the top 10. So we can be downtown central business district, get in a taxi, and I'm not exaggerating when I say in 10 minutes time, you can be in pristine jungle. It's pretty amazing, actually. It's one of the number one plus sides of living in Hong Kong. It's just the access to the countryside is amazing.
Yeah. And how does the landscape, I picture it as fairly mountainous. Is there a lot of topography? Is it a relatively flat landscape?
Yeah, it's pretty hilly here. Not massive mountains. The tallest, the highest being Lantau Peak, which is about 3,000 feet. I'm converting it for you there. but it's pretty hilly. A lot of water bodies. We've got a lot of islands, a lot of sea. We have marshes, mangroves, grasslands and jungle as well. So there's a lot of different, there's a very big variation of habitat here. So that probably explains why we have such diversity in reptiles and amphibians here. But I think the world over, the number one thing here is that they have protected habitat and they do their own thing, right? If you protect the habitat, you don't need to do anything else.
Yeah. And are those lands, are they protected, say owned by the government, or people allowed to access them to recreate, or do you have to have kind of official business to go there? How kind of is all that structured?
I think it's maybe the equivalent of your state parks. It's owned by the government. It's just highly restricted as to what you can do inside those areas. You know, you can't hunt, you can't dig, you can't excavate, you can't build, which is the main thing. Mm-hmm. You can access them 24 hours a day. There's no permits or anything like that. You can just go in for hikes. We've got beautiful hiking trails here. But the main one being there's such a demand for land in Hong Kong, one of the most densely populated cities in the world. This is enshrined in the law that they can't build within these country parks. So that's the number one thing. I mean, we do have some issues with like poaching, but in the case of snakes, it doesn't have a huge impact on the populations. With turtles, it's a bit different. They're more vulnerable to poaching. For the snakes, the main thing is having the habitat that they can thrive.
Yeah, and the poaching, I'm assuming, is for the pet trade or to be eaten, or kind of a combination thereof?
I think it's a combination. I think probably mostly the pet trade, because the value would be higher to sell a turtle in the pet trade than it would be to eat. There is also a traditional Chinese medicine. They do use wild animals, but I mean, I don't know. This is not based on any, you know, facts or research. My sense is it's probably mostly on the pet trade. Yeah, we have some critically endangered turtles here, native turtles, and they can be...
Yeah.
In the old days, like they before they were really breeding them in captivity, they were going for $20,000-$30,000 for one. So you can see why that would be appealing to poachers. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So you've got this landscape, almost half of it's protected, and you use the word jungle. So when you go up into these hills, I'm assuming. It's very tropical climate. I mean, is it a rainforest type habitat, or are these like, you know, kind of lush tropical forests, like you would think of jungle, or, what do the forests look like, just kind of in a general sense?
I guess Hong Kong is all secondary jungle. So it was all post-World War II aggressively replanted. And so you don't have the sort of lush tropical jungle that you imagine in, say, Southeast Asia and Thailand and places like that. But we have something not far off that in certain parts of Hong Kong, which is where we get the most biodiversity. The rest of it is more sort of tundra, bushland, nothing much taller than, say, 4 or 5 meters. And the soil is not particularly fertile. It's very shallow soil. It's quite clay. I think that there's quite a lot of clay in the soil. But the sort of jungly parts where I do my tours and other parts of Hong Kong is you could be in Thailand. It's not far off that. I mean, we're talking about tall trees, vines, lush bushes. You know, you'd have to hack your way through with a machete if you went off path, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned diversity and you said there's, relatively high diversity. So when we think about snakes, what are we talking diversity wise? You know, how many species do you have? Are there many rare species? Are there, many common species? Basically, what are kind of the snake communities look like on Hong Kong?
Well, just for a start, Hong Kong's only 1,000 square kilometers in total, which is 400 square miles, I think, something like that, 400 square miles. And we have about 45, 46 species of snakes in that small area. And it's a really diverse group of snakes. We have, we have the lapids like cobras, crates, coral snake, different from yours, and a king cobra, which is, obviously a marquee species. We have Burmese python. We have a couple of viper species and then, all the rat snakes and colubrids and things like that. So there's a real range, and blind snakes, which I think have invaded your neck of the woods. In Florida, I think you get the blind snakes, the non-native ones.
Yeah. So
we have like the world's smallest snake and one of the longest snakes. Exactly. Yeah, that's our gift to you. we have the world's smallest snake, or one of the world's smallest snakes, and we have one of the world's longest snakes and one of the world's most venomous snakes. We've got a real gambit there. We have the many-banded crate, which is, you know, listed as in the top 10 most venomous snakes in the world. So as someone who's interested, it's a fantastic place, fantastic to look for snakes. And they're very accessible. You can find them pretty easily, I mean, in relative terms, on a night out. You can find such a range of snakes. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So like in a lot of tropical areas, you're going out at night, it sounds like, then, to, you know, like if I'm down in the Amazon or somewhere in Central and South America, we're going out almost exclusively at night. And that's how you find snakes there?
Yeah, I used to spend a lot more time in the day when I was younger, because I think my parents were happier if I was going out during the day. You can still find stuff in the daytime, more restricted to the diurnal species, like, say, rat snakes and things like that, possibly king cobras. Nighttime, it's just more exciting. It's easier to find stuff. The nocturnal species are less skittish, so if you do see something, you've got more of a chance of getting up close, getting a photo. And yeah, just the quantity. I think at night you're more likely to see stuff, for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned, I just kind of want to drill down a little bit on some of the species you mentioned. So you mentioned a coral snake, but you said different than the one we have. So what is, tell me about the coral snake or snakes that you have there in Hong Kong.
Well, the coral snake, I don't know, the one in the U.S., this is the Cynomucrus McClendi, so McClellan's coral snake. This is a highly venomous lapid. It's short, fixed front fangs, semi-fossorial, so you don't see it very often. They feed on other snakes and also skinks, I think, and lizards. It's a very beautiful snake, but pretty uncommon. They get to about 2 feet, not even less than that. They're not big snakes. We have about 9 species of snakes in Hong Kong that we consider potentially dangerous, that can cause serious medical complications. Of those 9, maybe 3 or 4 have recorded deaths from bites from those snakes. What those snake species? What I will say, though, is in Hong Kong, we haven't had a snake death for, I think, 40 or 50 years now. And the last one was someone working. Yeah, it's a long, I mean, we do get snake bites, but we have good access to healthcare. And as you know, it's greatly exaggerated. The sort of get bitten and drop dead stories is exaggerated. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there are cases where that happens, but even with the crates, if you get bitten and you go to a hospital, there's very effective treatment. But the last fatality I heard of in Hong Kong was someone working in a snake soup shop. So snake soup is less popular than it was, but it's still a delicacy in Hong Kong. People eat this in the winter. It supposedly keeps them warm. Anyway, they were defanging the snake, and it wasn't a native species. I believe it was a Russell's viper from Thailand. They got bitten by it, and Hong Kong didn't have any anti-venom for Russell's vipers back then. They do now. And that person succumbed to that bite. But they did actually fly in anti-venom from Thailand, but it just came too late. But that was the last fatality in Hong Kong. I mean, we have 100 bites a year, maybe, from snakes here. Venomous snake bites, between 50 and 100, something like that.
Yeah. Well, we're on a little tangent, but I do want to talk about the snake soup. That's very interesting. So what species are they typically using for the snake soup? You said it sounds like non-native species are used, for one. Are they collecting a lot of snakes from Hong Kong for the soup, or are they mostly imported?
I think it's changed a lot. When I was a kid, and I used to go down to those shops just to look in the cages and stuff and see what they had. In those days, you would see like crates, king cobras, Chinese cobras, maybe even the occasional Burmese python, which are protected species in Hong Kong. Nowadays, you don't see any native snakes in those cages. They're all from farms in China, essentially. And I believe, and I don't know what the stats are on this, it's just anecdotal, but I believe a lot of the snakes that they eat in those soup shops now are frozen from China. And the ones that they have in the cages are just there for display to get people into the shop. You don't see those big, huge rat snakes, the big, huge king cobras, Chinese cobras. You really don't see those anymore. I think that's a sort of the reason for that is I think, A, they breed them more successfully in China now, the sort of rat snake species. B, there's less of those snakes around, unfortunately. C, there's more control over some of the protected species, like king cobra, which is, I think, CITES II. So they can't import them. And enforcement of illegal harvesting in Hong Kong has probably increased. There's more awareness that you can't grab snakes from the country parks and put them into cages and snake soup shops. What's actually interesting is and I think we'll talk about this later, but up until 2000, any snake that was found, any nuisance snake that was found in Hong Kong, would be removed by one of the snake soup shop owners. So they would actually get to keep the snake that they removed and bring it to their restaurant. That policy changed 22 years ago, but it gives you an idea.
Yeah, it makes some, you know, they have a lot of incentive to get lots of snakes, lots of nuisance snakes. Let's go back to some of the snakes and the king cobra. So we just did a whole episode on king cobras, kind of talking about them range-wide with a biologist from India. Fascinating conversation. But picture, you mentioned Hong Kong's what? Would you say about 500 square miles, something in that ballpark, and then about half of that's developed, it sounds like. So it's a relatively small landscape. A lot of it's protected, but it's interesting to me. So are there good numbers of king cobras, living on the landscape? Are they something you see commonly, or with a relatively small landscape, you know, are their numbers relatively low?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we often discuss this amongst my friends. Hong Kong Island itself is a small island, and they're never seen on Hong Kong Island. But the New Territories, which is a much bigger area, they come up all the time. And I don't know how much of that is due to social media, that when one is seen, everyone sees it, versus the population. I'm probably called to two or three a season to move king cobras. So they're not the most common snake, but they're certainly not uncommon. I run a Facebook group and they get posted probably every other week. Someone posts a picture of a king cobra in their garden or something like that.
Yeah. So they are still a relatively common animal. And if you're getting that many posts, I would think. So how about the banded crates? So where do you find these? Are you finding these closer to saltwater, I'm assuming, or, you know, how do you find them distributed? And tell us a little bit about their ecology, if you would.
Well, there's two crates. There's the many banded crate and the banded crate. The banded crate is the yellow and black one, very triangular shaped, keeled bodies. The mini banded crate is the black and white one, which is a really a marquee species around Asia, all the way up to India, because they're highly toxic venom, and they are responsible. They're sort of in the top kind of culprits, you could say, for snake bite death in Asia. A very, very strong, pure neurotoxic venom, distinct to the mini banded crate. It's so they actually inhabit, I think, generally the lowlands, and not near sea, but they feed primarily on other snakes and skinks. So they will be in areas where there is a high snake population and more in the sort of jungly type areas. they get to about 1.2 meters, something like three or four foot. They're not an aggressive species, so there's very few cases of snake bite from the many-banded crane. I think one I heard of recently was a couple of years ago. One of the guys at the university, one of the professors, actually picked one up, thinking it was a banded wolf snake, which is a mimic of the crate. And it's a bit of a rookie boy error, but that's not the first time that's happened, right? I think you probably heard about Joe Slawinski in Myanmar.
Yeah,
he got bitten. So this professor in Hong Kong, he got bitten, and you know, it's a very serious medical issue to get bitten by a many-banded crane. But I don't know the details of how long he was in hospital for, but he made a full recovery and he's fine. But definitely, that's the one snake you do not want to step on when you're walking around on these jungle paths.
Lights out. Time to sparkle, shimmer, and glow wild. Starting November 4th, the Little Rock Zoo transforms into a larger-than-light experience. Explore the tranquil jungle and discover enchanted realms glowing with mystical flora and fauna and prehistoric surprises. Spark your imagination after dark with wonders that illuminate memories. See the Little Rock Zoo in a new light at Glow Wild. Tickets on sale at littlerockzoo.com.
And then, you know, the last ones I want to ask you a little bit more. You mentioned multiple vipers, and I'm just a viper fanatic. So what vipers do you have there at Hong Kong?
Well, the main one we have is the bamboo snake. What's it? The Trimeratorus arboreus. That's the, should we say, 95% of snake bite cases in Hong Kong are from this one species. The reason being is they're very, very common. They're everywhere. They don't move out of the way. Typical sort of viper behavior. They're in ambush and they rely on their camouflage not to move, and people step on them or put their hand on them or whatever it is. So nearly all snake bite in Hong Kong is from this one species. And there's a couple other vipers which are much, much rarer. There's a the mountain pit viper, which only has been documented on two mountains in Hong Kong. They're typically they quite like the cooler climate, and they are on the highest and second highest mountain of Hong Kong. That's it. That's the only place you'll ever see them, and you'll only see them in the winter, and you know, in January. It will be 5-6 degrees outside. I can't convert that one, I'm afraid. So the mountain pit viper is very rare. And then we have a pointed scale viper.
Have you been able to see one of those? Very low, localized.
I have. I've only seen one. You need to be really dedicated if you want to find those. Go to the specific spot, the specific time of year, and go several times. And I did do that with a friend of mine. And we did see one beautiful one. I'm happy to tick that one off my list. I like going out and seeing more snakes rather than spending sort of weeks looking for one particular species. I'm quite happy to go out and see half a dozen snakes in a night. That's my preference.
Yeah. So you mentioned the viper that, you know, accounts for many of the bites in Hong Kong. So I was going to ask you, so how many of the species, are there many snakes that you typically find get into the more developed, you know, the city areas? Does this viper get in there? Are there other kind of common, say, colubrids or small lapids or whatever it might be that, you know, you commonly find throughout the city, or are most of the snakes kind of restricted to these more wild areas?
I mean, they are primarily in the wilder areas, but they do end up finding themselves in the city. We have, you know, because of the amount of rain we get in Hong Kong, we have an extensive drainage system below street level. And I think a lot of these snakes get washed down the hillsides into these drains and pop up in the middle of town. You know, there's a huge subterranean network of drains, and people will say, how the hell does this snake end up in Pedder Street, you know, the main street in the center of town? And because Hong Kong's not huge, it's like, well, it's only about a mile to the hillside, but you can do that whole mile underground in this drainage system. So you do there was a crazy video that was posted recently in Hong Kong of a guy, an official snake catcher, catching a king cobra in HSBC, a bank here in one of their, you know, you get these rooms with the ATMs in them, a private room. It was inside one of those. And this guy was catching this, 4 or 5 foot king cobra. He had no idea what he was doing. He stepped on its head and bent over to pick it up, lost control. And this thing lunged at his foot, hit his shoe. I mean, you're talking about 2 inches away from his ankle. And he managed to get control of it and catch it. But it's just the most bizarre thing in the center of one of the busiest areas in the whole world. There's a guy wrestling a king cobra. Crazy.
Wow. I think that's a good transition point, because I do want to talk about you. I forgot how you called it, but you said licensed snake catcher. So kind of what's the system in Hong Kong? And I believe you're part of this. You said, there are certain groups of people that are licensed or certified, and go out and kind of catch nuisance snakes. And is that accurate?
Yes. So the process in Hong Kong is, if someone finds a snake in their garden or in their house, workplace or school, they'll call up the police. That's the typical response. The police will come. If the snake is in situ and it's still there, they will then call a official snake catcher. So each district will have one or two, and the snake catcher will come, catch the snake, bag it, and give it to the police, who will then transport the snake in the bag to a place called Kaduri Farm, which is a conservation agency, who will document it and then release the snake. That's the process. So it's a process that replaced the old process, which is where they used to call the snake soup shops, and basically the snake was doomed. So it was an improvement upon that. And there was a lot of worry that whoever caught the snake would basically keep it to bring to these shops for money. So that's why they brought this process in involving the conservation agency, Kaduri Farm, which is great. 25 years ago when they brought it in, it was a big improvement. One of the things that I've been lobbying for the last 4 years is to change that process, whereby when the snake is caught in that situation, it's released immediately somewhere nearby. And I'm sure, as you know, translocation of snakes is not great. The stress of the transport is not great. And the treatment along the way is not great. So it makes, and then the resources that go into transporting it, the police take it to Kaduri, the Kaduri Farm have to process it. The whole thing can be a week from the minute the snake's caught to when it's finally released. It could be a week, and it's released in a random location. So the sort of campaigning I've been doing behind the scenes is to try and change that. And we had finally, after 4 years, had some success. And I am actually the first official snake catcher in Hong Kong that's allowed to release snakes. So now if I'm called to a snake, I can catch it and I can go and release it 500 meters away from where it was found. This is a pilot scheme just for my district. And the idea is that if it all goes smoothly, there's no complaints from the public, that they can roll this out territory wide. So it's pretty exciting, actually. In terms of conservation policy in Hong Kong for snakes, this is the most important one in 25 years. It's the biggest change. So, really exciting for that to happen.
We've done entire episodes on translocation, talked with scientists who've been studying the impacts on snakes, and obviously has a pretty big impact on their survival. So that's great. Glad to hear you're doing that. So how many of these registered snake catchers would there be in Hong Kong? You said one or two per district. Is that either 100 or are there 10 of you? How does that, structure?
I think roughly we're probably looking at maybe something in the region of 20 or 30 at the most, I think, in the whole of Hong Kong. My district, I'm the only one, and my district is the biggest island in Hong Kong. It's sort of double the size of Hong Kong Island. I live on Lantau, which is actually where you landed when you transitioned through Hong Kong. Actually probably less than 20. I'd say somewhere between 10 and 20 in the whole of Hong Kong. it's weirdly, it's a job position that they find trouble filling. the profile of the snake catchers has changed a lot. It's really interesting is traditionally it has been these snake soup shop owners, and culturally people are not going into that business anymore. So all the snake soup shop owners are in their 70s, 80s, really, really old. They're closing down. Their kids don't want to take over. Hong Kong's moving on from that kind of exotic species eating thing. And so the police are really struggling to find appropriate people to take on this role. But at the same time, there's this new generation coming in of young local guys and girls who have a interest in snakes. They have a genuine interest. They have passion. They have a conservation background. They actually know about snakes. They know what the species are they're catching. They know about translocation. This is a new generation. And this is purely on the back of the internet. You know, this is what I was talking to you earlier about, this community that's come around it. And it's really, really exciting to see that change. And this is what I've been using to push for the change. It's like the movement is something that's new. And we're just sharing that with the authorities. It's no longer pest control. It's conservation.
Yeah, you're doing very similar action or the same action, but you know you've kind of rebranded it into you know what it is. But so what is the process? If it sounds like it's a supply demand issue, there's not a great supply of these snake catchers. But if you wanted to become a snake catcher and to get certified or licensed, is it a long process where you have to go and kind of demonstrate abilities to handle snakes and do all of this, or is it something that's relatively quick?
Well, it's kind of neither of those two, really. It's not quick and it's not organized. I think it's just one of these weird things that's just fallen, you know, it's fallen in the cracks of government organization. It's just so few people that no one's really taken responsibility for it. If you want to become a snake catcher for the Hong Kong police, you have to apply and I guess give supporting reasons. There's no formal qualification, recommendation, process or test or anything like that. So when I applied, it was 7 or 8 years ago, I was recommended by an existing snake catcher for the police. And I attached a few press pieces I'd done, you know, there's a few bits coming out in the papers here, and just basically said, look, I have experience with snakes. I'm normal-ish. I'm not going to get bitten. I'm going to handle this safely. I'm not going to put myself at unnecessary risk. And I'm not going to embarrass the police by being unprofessional. I managed to convince them of all those things, and then I get the job. I think as this position formalizes more, there are some. For example, to be able to release the snakes in the wild, what's called a rapid release program that I'm the only one on, they do now have an exam for that, and I actually helped write the examination. But they do have that now. So potentially in the future, any new snake catchers will be made to sit that exam, and then hopefully they will be able to join this rapid release program. It actually makes sense because that means they have to be able to identify. It's a simple exam, but they have to identify the different species, you know, point out where's a suitable place to release them, things like that. And the old guard, these old soup shop owners wouldn't have a clue. They literally look at a piece of moving meat. It's not... you know, it's very, very different.
Yeah. Huh. So what, being a snake catcher, I mean, what's the life of a snake catcher? I mean, how frequently are you getting calls? Is this something that's semi-daily? Is it weekly? Less than that, I'm assuming that it might kind of shift seasonally as well. But, you know, how much of this time, of your time, does this take up typically?
Well, I'm lucky because I work from home. My normal business, I work from home. So it's easy for me to be on call, and you're on call 24 hours. But in the season, which runs from March to October, say, I'm probably called out once or twice a week. something like that. So it's enough to keep it interesting and not too much where it's a burden. Other districts, maybe they get caught a bit more. There's some more populated areas. They'll have more snake-human conflict. Where I live is pretty rural. So either they deal with the snakes themselves, the local villagers, with a stick, or they'll call the police. As I say, I'm on call. I'll get a phone call, could be any time of the day. You know, there's a snake found. Are you free? Yes. Okay, come to this location. Here's my colleague's number. I go there, catch it. It's pretty straightforward. But the location could be anywhere, you know, really. It's such random places. And for me, like, that's what keeps it fun. I've had an interest in snakes for so long, but kind of marrying it with this extra angle, you know, the police angle, the drama, where it is, the population, the complainant, just that keeps it really interesting because you don't know what you're walking into. It could be very dull or it could be very exciting. So you just don't know. I love it. I mean, I get paid as well. I mean, it's a small amount. It's about $100 US each time you catch a snake, but you know, that's not really the motivation. But it's quite nice when I get a parking ticket that I know that the police have paid me some cash the day before. I can give it back to them in my parking ticket.
you must have seen some really amazing things going on these calls. Some really strange things too, I would assume. So I want to transition and talk a little bit about these snake safaris. And so did the snake safaris come out of your experiences as a snake catcher? You know, you're interacting with a lot of people around snakes, and I'm sure you see a lot of fear. You see a whole wide variety of you know, reactions and how people think about snakes. And then you decide to launch this program. Did it come from that, or did it happen before about the same time? How did that all play out?
Actually, I set up a Facebook group around about the same time, and that Facebook group was incredibly active and grew very, very fast. And it came out of that. So within this group, people were always asking questions, and people were saying, "If you ever go out, can I come with you?" And it started like that, and it was never a plan to make it so kind of organized and formal. It was I took a couple of people out 1 year, and then I think the next year I charged them a little bit, and I thought, "Oh well, hold on a minute. There's a sort of market for this," and it just exploded. I mean, my safaris, I open them in February, and they fill up for the whole year, usually within about a week. There's a massive, massive demand for it. Huge. You know, I can't actually meet the demand, to be honest with you. And it's not something I ever in a million years would have thought I'd be doing at the age of 46, is taking people through the jungle looking for snakes. I never, you know, it's funny how life takes these turns. I love it. It's so nice to take these groups out. I get paid to do it. I'm doing what I love doing, and I'm meeting people. It sort of ticks so many boxes. And really, what's another amazing thing out of what comes out of this is I'm able to, in a very intimate kind of close way, is educate people about snakes. They can see it firsthand. They can say, "Hold on a minute, that's a bamboo snake. I've heard they're really aggressive and they chase you. Why isn't that one chasing you?" I'll say, "I don't know. You tell me. We'll find another one." "Oh, that one's not chasing you either." "Yeah, it's weird, that, isn't it?" You know, it's not just theory. It's they can see it up front. And they really, you know, I'm sure you've experienced it, but people really do believe this stuff. There's a common theory in Hong Kong that everyone talks about bamboo snakes because they're so common in snake bite, is that they fall out of trees and will bite you in the face. You know, they chase you around corners. So I had an argument with someone recently who said one chased him around a corner. This is a viper that moves very slowly. And no matter what I said, he wouldn't change his view. Now, had that guy come out on one of my safaris, he couldn't argue with, you know, seeing one in the wild. So it's really an amazing community that we've developed in Hong Kong. And this is through the other moderators as well, who've really helped. And what's really, really cool is it's actually amplified. I go into other groups, not snake groups. There'll be like community groups, neighborhood groups. And someone post a photo of a snake in their garden, go, "Oh, does anyone know what this is? I got to kill it." And everyone will jump on them now. No, you don't kill it. It's part of nature. Leave it alone. You can call the police, blah, blah, blah. But it's better if you leave it. If it's non-venomous, you can post it in Hong Kong. And we've got these little ambassadors and all the other groups. And it's made a huge impact. I mean, it really has made such a difference. And that was one of the reasons why I got sort of sucked into all of this, because I could see the results very quickly that no one was doing the lobbying that I do in the beginning. And I felt if I didn't do that, it's a disservice to conservation. When you have this opportunity where you can make a big impact in your little area, you have to do it. And I'm pleased, you know, and I now got other people doing it and I don't have to do as much or whatever, but it's really quite amazing the change that's happened here.
Thank you for listening to Snake Talk. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, you can help us by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star rating. Also, if you have any comments or suggestions, be sure to leave us a review.
It sounds like there's a lot of conservation value there, and you're changing people's minds, and you're changing just kind of the way these communities function and creating ambassadors, you know, as you said. And so did you go into it thinking that? Were you, when you came up with the idea for these safaris, was that why you developed it, to try to have an impact on the conservation of these species? Or was it, you know, just say another career move? But what was kind of the impetus relative to that conservation impact you're seeing?
I mean, honestly, it was purely because I enjoyed doing it. It was the primary driver. I thought, oh, this is fun. Let's see where this goes. And like a lot of things in my life, I just do what I like doing, and then hopefully good things come out of it. And it did. I'm a great believer when you just try things, don't overthink it. And if it feels right, just do it. And then you can sort of backfill purpose and reshape it how you will later on, but just start off like that. And it was people asking, and I enjoyed showing them, you know, sharing my passion and the sort of good halo effect of what's happened. I didn't plan it. It's just something that's happened. And I'm really sort of proud of that part of it. And I'm very excited by it. And that's what drives me to do it or keep doing it. I think it's a good thing. I think it's definitely a good thing.
Yeah, no, it sounds amazing. And it's a model that I think should be replicated more around the world. You know, basically you're doing snake ecotourism and having a huge impact on, you know, conservation of these animals. So that's great. So you said you're booked up, right through the next season. So will most of your guests that come out with you, will they typically be citizens from Hong Kong? Are you getting people traveling from afar? Are these mostly adults, kids? You know, who is it that's coming on these snake safaris?
Well, we spoke briefly prior. As you know, Hong Kong's pretty much been locked down from tourists for the last two and a half, three years. So pretty much 100% of my guests have been Hong Kong citizens. Who knows what happens when Hong Kong opens up, you know, we get more tourists again, but there's plenty of demand domestically for Hong Kong folks. And I think, I mean, I don't mind if it's tourists or Hong Kong, but it's quite nice catering to the local community. In terms of the sort of profile of people who come, it's a real mix. Local folks, expats, as we call them, sort of non-local citizens of Hong Kong, kids, adults. We try to limit the number of kids for each hike because I try to sort of pitch this hike safari as it's more interactive, educational rather than entertainment, if that makes sense. And what I don't want to be is basically have a bunch of kids and it's just trying to entertain them. I that's not for me. Mine is having, you know, kids that are really interested and parents that are interested and really talking it through and showing them, and then they get more out of it. I get more out of it. It doesn't pay enough for me to do this for the sake of doing it. I'm doing it because I enjoy it, and that's how I enjoy doing it. So that's how I frame it. One thing which was pleasantly kind of I've learned since doing this is that the people that are willing to go quite a remote area of Hong Kong on a Saturday night to go with some stranger looking for snakes in the jungle are actually really nice people, really outgoing and very intellectually curious people. They really want to learn. And so it's a sort of self-selecting group that join these things. And the other thing I've learned is actually quite a lot of very senior people, successful people join these hikes. I think it's a sort of amateur psychology experiment here, but I think people willing to sort of do something that's a bit unusual and put themselves out there a little bit kind of is reflected in how well they do generally in life. Like, you know, I'm not exaggerating when I say I've had sort of billionaires joining the hikes, you know, heads of business, all this kind of stuff. Like, it's a real, it's kind of crazy, actually, people with bodyguards and stuff. It's not what I expected when I first started doing these hikes. Which always worries me about my insurance. You know, you got this person, who they fall over down the stream, I'm in trouble. You know what I mean?
So walk me through a typical safari experience. Are they, you know, typically, you know, you take them out at night, I'm assuming, is it typically one night? Are they multi-day? Do you house the people? You know, what do you take them to do? Do you bring live animals? You only look for wild animals? Just kind of take us through maybe an average snake safari evening.
So we have a group between maybe 5 and 9, that sort of size. It'll either be just myself or I'll have a co-guide if it's the bigger group. And we'll meet usually around 7:30 at night, just as it's got dark. And we will spend the next 2.5-3 hours hiking up in the jungle, mostly on the path. We have these country park trails. We'll just go along those, and then maybe we'll go off piste a bit and drop down into one of the streams and do a little bit of stream trekking. Go up the streams because you get different species there. And sometimes I'll bring a snake or two with me if I've had a snake that of unknown origin, say someone has caught it and I don't know where, and so it's kind of doesn't matter where it's released, I'll bring it and I'll release it on the snake hike at the end of the hike and talk through that species. But generally, I mean, in 4 years, we've never not seen a snake on the snake safari. I mean, the numbers vary a lot depending on the weather and luck, but every single one, we've seen at least one snake, which for most people, that's good enough. A lot of people who come on these hikes have been in Hong Kong for 10, 15, 20 years and never seen a snake in the wild. And then they come on the hike and they see 2, 3, 4, 5 snakes and they're, you know, blown away, really, that there are so many snakes in Hong Kong. They didn't know. They had no idea. Even trail hikers, these guys that go hiking on the trails, and they'll say something like, oh yeah, I saw one 3 years ago disappearing off the path, you know. And then we go out and we go, there's one, there's one, there's one. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't realize that when I was walking amongst all of this, which is lends to what we're talking about earlier, is people's perceptions. They don't believe that a snake would necessarily leave you alone if you walked past it. I mean, there really is that basic level of fear.
Yeah.
One of the other things, I mean, what I forgot to mention, sorry. So if we see a snake, my tours are quite interactive. I know that there's some controversy about sort of interfering with wild animals, which I totally understand. But we will, if I see a snake in the tree asleep, I will grab it, take it out, let them have a close look at it, let them take photos of it and put it back. I feel as a sort of from a conservation point of view, you know, interfering that snake's life for 5 minutes, but having the impact on those 8 or 10 people for the rest of their lives is worth that trade-off. It educates them. It helps create ambassadors. It does a world of good for the sort of snake community, snake advocacy in Hong Kong. And so sometimes people will say, well, you know, you shouldn't disturb wildlife in the wild, which I totally get. And it has to be done in a respectful and responsible way. But at the end of the day, you know, in an ideal world, everyone would leave all animals alone completely. But it's just not an ideal world. So you have to kind of balance out the pros and the cons. So that's kind of my take on all of it. But I totally respect people that say you should just take photos and leave them alone. But that's, you know, I guess maybe this is a different topic. But anyway, that's my view on this.
So it sounds like these are incredibly popular. So how do you end up advertising for them? Or maybe it's just kind of word of mouth by now. Do you use this Facebook group? Is this something you advertise more broadly through, you know, the internet, newspapers, whatever it might be?
Yeah, it's just word of mouth. I don't advertise it. I mean, Hong Kong's a small place. It's a small community, and every now and again, there might be an article about snakes, and sometimes my name is referenced or mentioned. Or the Facebook group that I run has got 15,000 people in it, and most of those guys are in Hong Kong, so that's a pretty big reach. But I don't advertise it because what tends to happen is I get more people applying to join, and I have to turn them down, and they get annoyed. Or you know, I'd rather try and cater to the demand that I have and not. You know, if that sounds a bit strange from a business point of view, but yeah, that's just the way it is.
Well, you're not doing it for money, as you said. You're doing it because you enjoy it. So there's, you know, you're not looking to grow this thing to, you know, necessarily giant scale. But do you have a couple examples to kind of close out this discussion of the snakes? As far as a couple examples, maybe of you know, particularly memorable experiences you've had with people, you know, that would kind of lend to this whole impact on conservation, education, outreach component that you've been talking about.
You mean on the snake safaris? Well, there's so many little ones that add up to a big one, but there's a couple of memorable examples. So recently, there was in Hong Kong, they rebuilt the Peak Tram, which is a famous tourist attraction in Hong Kong. It's a tram that goes from town to the top of the peak, and it gets, you know, millions of visitors every year. They take this tram. They rebuilt the whole thing. It was like a 2-3-4 year project, and the terminus for it, they actually decided to use wildlife imagery from Hong Kong. And one of the guys in my snake safari was in charge of that whole project, a very senior guy. And so he was asking me about, you know, what snakes should they put and can you ID it and make sure it's correct and all this kind of stuff. And I think that has come out of just this increased community. So that's kind of one example, a small example. But on the safaris themselves, like one of the most exciting things, I think, in the 4 years, I can say, was I was with a co-guide and we kind of split the group into two, and he was going up the river and I heard him shouting my name. And he's like, Will, come here. And I thought he'd seen a python because they're pretty rare to see and everyone wants to see a python. I get there and there's a 11-foot king cobra on a rock eating another king cobra. It was insane. It's like, wow. You know, 10 o'clock at night, which you don't really see. And so I was with this group and I was like, geez, I said, I want you all to see this, but you've got to like stay back. And, you know, I was like, really, this is a new one for me. So I was trying to work out how I can get this group to have a good view of this. But at the same time, I'm very aware that once the king cobra is finished eating, he's going to be a bit like skittish. You know, once the snake finishes eating, they're a bit animated. He may shoot off in the direction of where my group is standing. So it was amazing. We watched it for about 15 minutes while it gobbled down this 6-foot king cobra. When it finished, it shot up a tree. It went about 30 feet up a tree. It was just the most insane thing to see. That was definitely one of the highlights of the last 4 years of doing these snake safaris. That was one of the best ones.
Well, that's great. I'm certainly glad that you're doing it. And again, I think it's a great model, and I think it's something that I hope people would start considering in other parts of the world, you know, especially because of just those, you know, positive conservation impacts you're seeing. So again, thank you for doing that. Before we wrap up here, I'd like to ask all of my guests to tell me their best snake story. Do you have one that kind of stands out in your mind?
Oh, so many. It's a hard question, but I think a few that spring to mind. I think, just from a personal point of view, I think finding an anaconda in Peru was a highlight in my snake background. But in Hong Kong, I think from police catching snakes, catching king cobras is always very exciting. I was called to a prison here, and they had a 10-foot python in a drain that this python had been eaten. They had some prison cats, and they had a lot less cats because of this python. They called me to this prison, and you go through the whole process of, you know, the metal detector and leave your phone and blah, blah, blah. Finally, you go through all these fences, you get in, and they just point to this drain, and it's about a 10-foot ladder down a drain, and there's 5 feet of water, and there's this 10-foot python sat in the water. There you go. Go get it, please. It's like, okay. it was just surreal. So, right? In the middle of a prison yard, climbing down to catch this thing.
How did you catch it? Was it pretty mellow, or was it ramped up?
Well, actually, I found through trial and error that when a python is in the water, they feel secure. When they're underwater, they feel secure, so they don't try and bite you. So I could sort of climb down, stand next to it, and then grab it. It was okay, but it's just the whole situation was kind of a bit surreal. Sometimes there's not these crazy stories, but it's like when someone calls and there's a Chinese cobra under their kid's bed, and I just think to myself, okay, this is why I have this job. This is why this policy is in place. This is why the police are involved. This is why it is all of this. This kind of brings it home, because so many times you're called out for nonsense, for a rat snake in a garden or some spurious reason where you think it's a waste of everyone's time. But every now and again, you get these cases where, wow, okay, there was literally a Chinese cobra under a six-year-old's bed. And you think, okay, I'm glad at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm glad that I was able to help and it was safely resolved. So it's just such a mix of situations. I mean, I love it. It's such good fun. But it's hard to pick out one, to be honest with you.
Great. Well, thank you, William, for everything you do. And thank you so much for being on Snake Talk.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a real pleasure.
Great. And I just wanted to thank the audience and tell everybody to remember, snakes are animals too. And it's a privilege to see one in the wild.